From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, putting a human face on welfare reform, we meet New York Times reporter Jason DeParle. His new book is American Dream: Three Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. He followed a trio of families living in Milwaukee to find out how they fared under new laws aimed at getting them into the workforce. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews The Great Divide, a new CD from saxophonist Von Freeman. And we'll hear about the highlights of the fall TV season from critic David Biancooley. He'll tell us his top picks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Kidnappers in Iraq have murdered an American hostage who was abducted last week in Baghdad. The killers put video on the internet showing the beheading of U.S. contractor Eugene Armstrong. The group had demanded the release of all Muslim women held in two prisons, and they threatened to kill another hostage in 24 hours if their demands are not met. In New York City today, John Kerry delivered his most aggressive attack yet on the president's policy in Iraq. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
John Kerry has been put on the defensive by President Bush, forced to explain his past statements about Iraq again and again. But today he tried to turn the tables, focusing on the president's policy, which he said was a profound diversion from the battle against Osama bin Laden. And he said invading Iraq has created a crisis of historic proportions.
Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator who deserves his own special place in hell. But that was not in and of itself a reason to go to war.
Kerry said the president's two main rationales, the weapons of mass destruction and the Al-Qaeda September 11th connection, have been proved false, and he attacked the president for saying he would do it again the same way. Kerry said the administration has overpromised, underperformed, and held no one accountable, including the president. Mara Liasson, NPR News, New York.
President Bush quickly responded to Senator Kerry's speech, accusing the Democratic challenger of changing his mind on Iraq again. He characterized Kerry's position as one of believing that the U.S. would be safer if Saddam Hussein were still in power.
He's saying he prefers the stability of a dictatorship to the hope and security of democracy. I couldn't disagree more, and not so long ago, so did my opponent.
The president heads to New York City tomorrow for a speech before the United Nations, which refused to back the war in Iraq. President Bush has formally lifted sanctions on Libya in the latest reward to Muammar Gaddafi for agreeing to give up weapons of mass destruction. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Bush suspended key sanctions in April to allow U.S. oil companies to start negotiating deals with Libya. Now the president has signed executive orders formally lifting the trade embargo, restoring air links to Libya, and freeing Libyan assets that were frozen in the mid-1980s. Libya wanted to see all of this done this week before it agreed to hand out further compensation to the families of the victims of Pan Am Flight 103. The Libyan government accepted responsibility for the 1989 bombing that killed 270 people, but much of the $2.7 billion compensation package was tied to the lifting of U.S. sanctions. Libya, for now, remains on the State Department's list of countries that sponsor terrorism. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow lost 79 to close at 10,204. This is NPR News. A Food and Drug Administration official says there are problems with prescription drugs bought from a Canadian internet pharmacy that came into the U.S. by a circuitous route. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
Many pharmaceutical manufacturers have cut off supplies to Canadian internet pharmacies that serve U.S. customers looking for a bargain. So the pharmacies have turned to European countries. In July, the FDA seized drugs ordered from Europe by CanadaRx.net and shipped through the Bahamas. Now the FDA's Bill Hubbard says the agency can identify some of the pills, though there's no proof of counterfeiting. He says many of the drugs can be bought more cheaply in the U.S. A co-owner of CanadaRx.net says the drugs were purchased from one of Europe's largest and most reputable wholesalers, and he says while generic drugs may be cheaper, people are still getting a bargain with brand-name products. Joanne Solberner, NPR News, Washington.
There was more violence today in Afghanistan. One of the country's four vice presidents escaped being hit by a roadside bomb in the northern Kunduz province. Afghan police said the official was in a 20-vehicle convoy on his way to inspect a road construction project. The attack came less than a week after Afghan President Hamid Karzai escaped a rocket attack on a U.S. military helicopter that was carrying him to a political campaign event. Meanwhile, U.S. military officials say two American soldiers were killed in a skirmish with rebels near the border with Pakistan. Two other Americans and six Afghan soldiers were wounded in that attack. In stocks, the Nasdaq lost 2 points to close at 1,908. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Rocky Mountain Institute, publisher of Winning the Oil Endgame, a strategy for ending oil dependence in the U.S. and worldwide, available at oilendgame.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The 1996 Welfare Reform Law, known as the Personal Responsibility Act, has by some measures been a remarkable success. Driven by time limits for benefits and work requirements, and buoyed by an expanding national economy, 9 million people have left the welfare rolls, and many have joined the workforce. My guest Jason DeParle is a senior writer for the New York Times and has covered poverty in America for most of his 20-year career. Interested in whether the new laws could truly transform the lives of single welfare moms, he spent 7 years following three women and their extended families in Milwaukee, where Wisconsin's welfare reform is considered a national model. The result is his book, American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Well, Jason DeParle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You followed three extended families in Milwaukee, women and their children who were involved in the welfare reform experiment that's widely regarded as among the most successful. How did you get such intimate access to these folks and their lives over such a long period of time?
Well, it happened bit by bit. I first met a woman named Opal Caples who, in a welfare office in the summer of 1997, and she was very open and friendly and inviting. Invited me to come tag along with her. She was working at, she was on welfare, but she was working at a hospital. So I went and spent a few nights doing the. She was a cleaning woman in a night cleaning woman in a hospital. I spent a few nights doing the rounds with her, and she told a very frank, candid account of her life, growing up in the projects in Chicago and having been thrown out of various schools and gotten pregnant and gone on welfare, and seemed not the least bit interested in burnishing her image in any way, but said as an aside, you know, one thing I never did in my life was drugs. That's just one thing I never got into. And I went to her house, and there was a big no drugs sign on her door, and her boyfriend was wearing a no drugs sign on his lapel. And I came to find out a couple months later she was on drugs. She was addicted to crack and was in the process of backsliding at that point. And within 9 months, she had lost her job and was pregnant, homeless, living on the streets, and wound up living in a crack house. Throughout that time, Opal surprisingly remained open to seeing me, hearing from me. I found her a few times when she was living in the crack house. We went out to dinner. And through her, when eventually she, before her baby was born, she was about 8 months pregnant, she came off the streets and went to live with one of her cousins. So through Opal, I met the cousin, and through that cousin, there's three women. The book focuses on three women. They're cousins that they form a trio together in Milwaukee. They live together for many years and are not only cousins but best friends, almost co-parents to each other's children. So I met the other two women through Opal, and they were initially, I think, harder to get to know than Opal. Although, as Opal's problems compounded, she kind of drifted away, and I was left with Angie and Jewel, who hadn't initially signed up to be part of the journalism experiment. But there we were with each other, and I think over time they grew comfortable with me.
One of the policy underpinnings of welfare reform is the notion that welfare has created among the community it serves a culture of dependency, that people feel entitled to government assistance, and that sort of attitude needed to be modified. To what extent does that describe the women that you got to know so well?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about the word dependency because it didn't describe them in any way. The other word that came up a lot in the discussion of welfare was entitlement. There was a feeling that the poor were besotted with a culture of entitlement. And what really struck me about Angie and Jewel's story is how little they felt they were entitled to. They leave welfare, they go to work, and they become successful workers. Angie and Jewel out-earned about 80 to 85% of the women leaving the rolls in Wisconsin. Yet even as successful workers, they lose their lights, they lose their health insurance. Jewel winds up having her wages garnished. They find times when they run out of food. They didn't feel entitled to, and part of what struck me about that is how it was no surprise to them. At one point, Jewel winds up with her wages garnished for, after losing her health insurance, she winds up with a hospital bill and her wages are being garnished to pay off the bill. I asked her about it. She said, she looked at me and said, well, everybody who goes to work in Milwaukee is going to have their wages garnished. That her expectation was, it wasn't a surprise at all.
Clearly, one of the things that made the lives of these three women difficult was the fact that they were single moms with a lot of kids, generally begun in their teenage years. Jewel, who you mentioned, became pregnant in high school. To what extent was that an accident or a conscious decision on her part to become a teenage mom?
The three women had different experiences in that way. Opal actually got married and had her kids when she was married. Angie, I would say, had her kids by accident. But Jewel, who you asked about, was in a very unhappy situation at home. There was a stepfather in the house who she didn't get along with at all. And she very consciously set out to have a child. Her older sister, who had gotten pregnant in high school and gone on AFDC and became a single mother and kind of worked her way off it, went to community college. She was trying very hard to convince Jewel to end the pregnancy, not to go through with it. And Jewel just had her mind made up that she wanted something to love. She wanted something of her own. You know, you hear those stories from time to time about teenage girls wanting a child to love. And usually what happens is then they find out how difficult it is and find out that it wasn't as simple as they had thought. In Jewel's case, I think it sort of did work the way she wanted it. It became her baby became the center of her life, and I don't think she ever had any regrets about it.
One of the elements of welfare reform was to put welfare recipients through job readiness classes, which is designed to provide motivation and life skills. You know, that people need to be regular participants in the workforce, getting there on time, you know, showing the right kind of manners, dressing properly, et cetera. To what extent was that kind of instruction relevant to the women that you spoke to?
Very little. In fact, that was one of the big surprises for me of the book. I thought most of the content of the book would be a back and forth between the women and the welfare system, that they would be in an office, go through a class, get some guidance, go out and find a job. The job wouldn't work out. They come back. And there'd be a sort of a long, extended back and forth with a caseworker or with the office that much of the book would take place in that location. What happened with Angie and Jewel is as soon as they changed the rules and said, now you have to perform a community service job in order to get a check, they immediately went out and got jobs on their own. I mean, Jewel said, why would I do that? Why would I work for, as she put it, work for free when I could go out and work and get paid? Jewel had been on welfare for 8 years and had no education and still went out and was able to find a job within a few months. Angie had been on for 12 years and had no high school education and did the same thing. They were much more capable of holding jobs than any of us had expected, anybody in the professional welfare community, and you know, certainly than I had expected. Getting into work was not a problem at all. At times, keeping the work was a problem, and certainly the rewards of the work was a problem. It didn't pay much or bring them much.
But those who did, the two you write, who did find work when the welfare system required to find it, I mean, a lot of people would regard that as a success. I mean, it reduced the welfare rolls. To what extent did it transform either of their lives and give them, you know, a lever to upward mobility?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between two subjects here, which tend to get conflated. One is, what did it do for them? And the other is, what did it do for their kids? Let me take the main character, Angie, in the book. She goes to work as a nursing aide in a nursing home. And some of your listeners may not realize just how difficult and actually even dangerous that work is. I was astonished to discover that nursing aides get injured at twice the rate of coal miners. It's because they're lifting all the time. They're lifting patients from all kinds of awkward angles, all kinds of awkward times. Sometimes the patients fight back. They make about $7.50 an hour, and about a fifth of them don't even have health insurance. So it's a turnover in some of those nursing homes runs 100% a year. It can be a real sweatshop job. And Angie goes into that work, and she really flourishes in it. She really likes it. She likes the wearing the smock. She likes thinking of herself as a nurse. She likes the atmosphere. She really likes the patients. It brings out a wonderful empathetic vein in her. I always thought she had more patience for her patients than she did for her kids. She's in a nursing home cleaning an elderly, frail, frightened elderly white woman who looks up at Angie and snaps at her, "Get your hands off me, you know what." Angie is African-American. It's a racial slur. On the streets, that would have completely set Angie off. You know, she might have gone in her pocket and pulled out a knife. With this woman on the ward, Angie just laughed and said, "Well, the you know what is cleaning you because you can't do it yourself, and so you might as well let me." And you know, I asked her about it afterwards. She said, "Well, you know, old people, they're stuck in their ways. They're not responsible for what they say." I spent a lot of time thinking about, gee, what was it about this work that brought out that creative, empathetic, kind quality in Angie? There's actually some ethnographies of nursing home workers. And the question is, why would they do this kind of work when in some cases fast food pays more? And the answer is they're drawn to a caretaking role. They find something rewarding just about being a caretaker. The second part of the rewards we hope that someone would get from work, though, has to do with their kids. And the idea isn't just that we want the women to have more pride and dignity and self-esteem. Those are all words you hear. I mean, I think in Angie's case, her work did bring all those things. But the second half of the equation is, well, what's it going to do for her kids? Is she going to become a role model for her kids? And this is where I'm a little more pessimistic. The idea of mothers being role models for their children has a great intuitive appeal. It's something, but by you know, mothers who go to work being role models for their children, is something we'd all like to believe. The question in this context is, you know, how much is it true when a low income single mother goes to work? And she's living in a dangerous inner city neighborhood, and she's away more. How much does that do for her kids? And Angie's kids actually missed more school after she went to work than they did before. Their school absent, they were absent about 20% of the time in the years she was on welfare, and their absentee rate rose to about 26% of the time after she went to work.
You mentioned that Angie did well in her work as a nursing assistant. I mean, a lot of advocates of welfare reform would say, well, that's exactly what we want to see, and what should happen next is that she should move up the ladder, she should become a supervisor, then she'll get more of an income and be able to move towards a middle-class life. To what extent was that a real possibility?
You know, it just never happened for Angie, and she tried so hard. At one point, she worked two jobs. She worked two jobs and went to school. She took out a loan and got a car and applied for that let her do temp work in a suburb 30 miles away because it paid more. And she was never able to the only way she could really work up to get a better wage was she needed more education. She couldn't pass her GED test. She tried three or four different times. She did pass a computer course. She applied for a more of a clerical job in medical records. She didn't get it. And throughout this time, she was getting she would get semi-annual raises of 25 cents. One year, she got a semi-annual raise of 9 cents. Angie was working about as hard as I know of a person being able to work, and her lights were being cut off, or she was running out of food. She was going without health insurance. I just can't imagine a woman working harder than Angie did, and yet she never really was able to crack, say, the $10 an hour barrier without getting more education, and you know, she couldn't do that.
My guest is writer Jason DeParle. His book on three women coping with welfare reform is called American Dream. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Jason DeParle. His book is American Dream, Three Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Well, one thing, of course, that was missing in most of these three women's lives for most of the time that you looked at them was a stable, committed father. And you've made the point that that's really a big missing piece, that it takes a family to climb out of poverty, and it's very hard for a mom on her own to do this. One of the men in your story, Ken Thigpen, becomes a guy who decides to stick, in part because his dad didn't stick. Tell us about him. What made him different?
Dave, everything in the book surprised me. Everything that happened from this story for a decade went against it, the way I would have predicted it. And this is a perfect example. Through most of the reporting, Ken was in prison, and I hadn't even met him yet. But what I knew about him was that he was a drug dealer, a violent guy, and that he was also, a pimp, that he was running prostitutes and drugs while Jewel was initially dating him. And then he got caught on a drug charge and went to prison for a couple of years. And the day he got released, I went and picked him up at the prison. I took Jewel, the prison's a couple hours away from Milwaukee, and we drove out there to pick him up as he's coming out of prison. There was nothing in his record that suggested there was anything about him that was about to turn around. And I figured within a few months he'd be back in jail. That was sort of his pattern. And actually, he later told me he more or less figured the same thing. And yet he got out of jail. This was more than 4 years ago. And, it was a classic scene, He's out of jail for a couple of weeks. Somebody comes by. One of his prison buddies comes by. He doesn't have a job. He's frustrated. He doesn't have any money. He can't get hired. A friend comes by and drops off an ounce of cocaine. And it's like one of those Saturday morning cartoons, there's a bird on each shoulder, take it, don't. And he just decides he's had enough of prison after he's almost 30 at this point. He spent half his adult life in prison. He gets rid of the cocaine and he goes and eventually becomes a pizza delivery man, which is what he's been doing for the last 3 years, with no signs of going back to the street life at all. He's had a son. He and Jewel had a son, kind of almost a miracle baby, because various medical complications, they thought they were going to lose the pregnancy. And Ken is out of this whole circle, the rare guy who's stayed at home and raised this kid. Jewel works in a nursing home in the mornings. Ken takes care of Kivion, and she comes home from the nursing home, and he goes out and does his pizza rounds at night.
And how does that fit in with the culture of the community around him? How tough is it him to be a... I mean, he's essentially a stay-at-home dad.
Here's the real sad part of the, so I've just told you the uplifting part of the story. Here's the sad part of the story. People looked up to him more when he was selling drugs. Some of the kids in the neighborhood now, they kind of mock him as, pizza guy. They looked up to him more when he used to be more fun when he was selling drugs. They said he had more money, he used to take them places. Now look at him. So again, the notion that that work is going to lift up the younger generation, that's another case in which it hasn't played out. He's got so much strength to be able to keep doing this. One of the things I found with all with Ken and with Angie, how little support they get sometimes when they're doing what we would call the right thing, when they're leaving welfare and going to work, when he's avoiding selling drugs and going to work. Just how little emotional support. Ken got a few, I wrote about him in the New York Times Magazine, and he got a handful of letters afterwards, and maybe a couple small checks. It wasn't a lot. Frankly, I was hoping maybe something better would come his way. But it meant so much to him. He told me he'd never had. He was just stunned that anybody would write him and say. I mean, people wrote some nice things that, glad you're taking care of your son. You're doing the right thing. It was totally outside his frame of reference that somebody could read about him in a magazine and sit down and write him. And he had so little public affirmation. That for somebody would tell him, hey, you're doing a good job. That was just outside his experience. He told me it was the best thing that had happened to him since the birth of his son. In 2.5 years, getting these letters was the best thing that had happened to him.
Now, what do you think policymakers should learn from this? I mean, the Bush administration and people in Congress have begun to think about this, how to encourage more two-parent families. And Bush is pushing, I guess it's called the Healthy Marriage Program, right? And does a kind of a public information campaign designed to encourage marriage. What's your sense of how much of this is worth pursuing? Does it have an effect? Can it work?
I think quite a lot of it's worth pursuing. Of course, the depends on what you're saying, what we mean by it. But what I mean is there's a in the welfare law is being reconsidered by Congress now, and there's a provision in there that would provide $1.5 billion over I think 5 years for programs to promote healthy marriages. I'd like to see the definitions of that expanded a little bit so that it would include not just a kind of counseling and public information campaign, but also some employment skills, some job efforts for training for the guys. But I think that moving in the direction of bringing the men back in the family has got to be the next direction for public policy. Nobody really knows how to do that. The employment programs for low-skilled men have a discouraging record, but you know, so did the employment programs for low-skilled women for 20 years until enough things were tried that people figured out how to get women like Angie and Jewel into the workforce and even how to support them a little bit. So I view the male side of the equation being where the female side was 20, 25 years ago. But it's the crucial next direction to help low-income families.
Writer Jason DeParle. His book is called American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. He'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting The Al Franken Show, political commentary, comedy, and interviews, premieres weeknights at 11:30 on Sundance Channel, and from Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of A Place of Hiding, the new Inspector Lindley mystery novel set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jason DeParle. He followed 3 Milwaukee families on welfare for his new book, American Dream. Also, a review of the new album from sax player Von Freeman. TV critic David Biancooley gives us a preview of the new fall lineup. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, New York Times writer Jason DeParle, has covered poverty in America for most of his career. His new book follows three women and their kids coping with welfare reform. It's called American Dream. It sounds as if you think, you know, liberals who would mock welfare reform as utterly ineffective and point to families that may have gotten jobs but never made it out of poverty as evidence that this is all a misguided adventure. Give us your sense. I mean, has this showed us that public policy can do some things right?
Yeah, someone asked me, does the story you tell have hope? And I had to stop and think for a minute because, you know, it's a story of people with wages garnished and lights turned out and kids getting pregnant in high school and lots of setbacks. But I think it is, and I think it is for two reasons. One, Angie and Jewel become workers against all expectation. You know, and that's a success. That's a success for their lives. It doesn't take them as far as we had hoped, but it gets them. There's no solution to poverty without them working, so it gets them a start, and it gives them a kind of civic enfranchisement. Also, I mean, no one can say, "Hey, they're takers. Hey, they're on the welfare rolls." You know, they're now workers. They're now part of they have moral claims on us in a way I think that they didn't before. And I feel hopeful about what they've achieved in that sense, and I feel some hopefulness about what the country has achieved. I started the poverty beat for the New York Times at the end of the Reagan years. When I first started writing about these issues, it's a little hard to conjure now just what an atmosphere of pessimism and defeat there was in the field. Reagan had said, "We fought a war on poverty, and poverty won." The notion was that there's nothing you can do to make the world better for these people. It's anything we do is doomed to failure. And I think the legacy of the 90s is that things did get a little better. Poverty rates came down, employment rates rose dramatically. There's a debate about how much of that was due to welfare reform and how much was due to the economy, but clearly government policy was a big part of the solution, a big part of what had happened. And I think it gives us all reason to believe in anti-poverty policy again. There's no excuse for cheap cynicism anymore.
Opal Caples was a woman who, one of the women that you got to know very well, one of the first that you met. She actually appeared with Governor Tommy Thompson at one point, I think, in an appearance, and it turned out that she had a pretty serious drug abuse issue. How did the welfare system deal with that? I mean, clearly it's not an uncommon problem among the welfare community. How well did the welfare reform system approach that obstacle to upward mobility?
Astonishingly poorly. Milwaukee privatized the welfare system, so there were five different private agencies in Milwaukee serving. They served six different districts. She was at three of the five agencies over a three-year period. She had six caseworkers at three different agencies. None of them ever figured out she was on drugs, even though it had been noted in previous case files. At one point, she had sold off all her furniture to buy drugs, and she was out of food, and the kids were going to school dirty, and she was so frightened and desperate, she walked into the welfare office at a place called the Opportunities Industrialization Center and begged to be seen. And you know what the receptionist told her? "We don't take walk-ins. Go home and make an appointment."
Now, this is, I guess, a reflection of the chaos that occurred when Wisconsin handed so much of the case management over to private companies. The idea was there were supposed to be smaller caseloads and people were going to manage clients' needs, not just hand out checks. Why did the practice not meet up to the theory?
Yeah, that was one of the huge surprises of the book for me was what a bad job these private agencies had done. And I don't think it's a part of the Wisconsin story that's widely known. You know, Wisconsin won the biggest award and for biggest government award in the country for its the efficiency of its welfare system. And
was that the Innovation in Government Award?
Yeah, it's an award given out by Harvard and the Ford Foundation. There were two problems in the Wisconsin system. One was financial. Opal, for most of her time, was with an agency called Maximus. It's actually a for-profit company, a welfare agency that trades on the New York Stock Exchange. Actually, it's a large national company with contracts in almost every state, and they took over the management of one of these districts in Milwaukee. And part of what was dismaying about what they did there was the waste of money. They spent at least $1 million, probably more, of welfare dollars, not on the client services, but just on promoting themselves, on burnishing the corporate image. They had ran TV ads and bus ads and billboards. They even printed up Maximus golf balls, you know, for all the golfers on the rolls. They spent $25,000 to bring in Melba Moore, the fading Broadway star, to give a concert to clients. All this was meant to kind of promote Maximus, as burnish their image, make them seem like to win publicity.
All of this charged to Wisconsin taxpayers?
Yes, out of welfare dollars. Absolutely. Yeah. Some of that eventually came out and became known, but I think what isn't known is just the level of how little service the clients got in the program. At Maximus, one caseworker was arrested for soliciting kickbacks from clients. Another was quietly pushed out the door because women were complaining that he was forcing them to have sex with them in order to get their benefits. At least two of Opal's caseworkers were drug addicts. One of them wound up getting arrested for passing bad checks and wound up on the rolls herself. Another caseworker was quietly pushed out the door after impregnating a client. I mean, this is not a big office. You know, this is not a big. The head of the office had his wife, his son, his niece, his mistress, and his mistress's mother all on the payroll. The number two in the office had her son on the payroll until he went to jail for murder, for reckless homicide. He ran over his girlfriend's father and killed him. These were the service providers in Wisconsin.
If that's the performance of the people who were managing cases, it makes you wonder what might have been achieved had this been done well.
Right. So we've gone from the money to the managers. So here's the clients. So in 3 years on the system, the ethos of the Wisconsin system was everyone was supposed to be working. If you couldn't get a job, we'd give you a community service position. So out of the whole Maximus caseload, there was an internal study, 8% were working. This was in a program that billed itself as 100% work, billed itself to the Ford Foundation, to Harvard, to the New York Times, is celebrated across the world as promoting and achieving universal work, and 8% of the people were working.
Well, what were the other 92% doing? Were they'd simply disappeared from the role?
Yeah, I asked the head of the office, you know what he said? And he said, what were they doing? I don't know what they were doing. They were doing nothing, which is what Opal was doing. She was sitting at home doing that. At one point, she was in a crack house. She was literally living in the crack house. They were sending her the checks at the crack house.
And she was more crack. And she was allowed to get the check because what? She was believed to have been working on a job or getting training or?
Oh, no, just the bureaucracy was in such chaos. They didn't know what her caseworkers didn't know what she was doing. Plus, there was huge case turnover within the caseload. So for months at a time, she wouldn't have a caseworker. Her system would be kind of an automatic pilot. Then she'd get a new one. Plus, Opal was pretty good at playing the bureaucracy. You know, playing the system, they'd call her in for an appointment, and then she wouldn't show up, and they'd send another letter, you know, a month later, and then it just went on and on and on and on and on. I don't want to sound like I'm picking on Maximus, because if it was just one agency, I would think, okay, well, all right, there's one bad manager, there's one bad example. The thing is, she was at three different agencies, and exactly the same experience replicated at each one. The next one was Goodwill, which of course has a sterling national image as a nonprofit service provider. And her caseworker there, I had taken Opal to the dentist right before she met her caseworker. Opal had 10 teeth pulled. I mean, Opal was a tragic case at this point. Her hair was literally falling out. Her teeth were falling out. She goes in to see this caseworker, and the caseworker gives her a few months to look for a job on her own and sends her a check. So I eventually went to see the caseworker and said, why? What were you? She said, well, Opal, she said, she looked good appearance-wise. She seemed like she had her home life intact. Well, I don't know how she could have known anything about her home life because she had never visited her at home. And, you know, as for looking good, she just, her hair was falling out and she had 10 teeth pulled. But there was a kind of it was astonishing that they continued to neglect her that way. And at the end, she lost her children.
So how is it that these private agencies brought in to manage this got so little done?
Part of it had to do with the financial structure of the Wisconsin program. When they privatized to these agencies, they set up the financing similar to an HMO, in which they gave these private agencies a set amount of money and said, you manage this caseload. So if the caseload goes up, you lose money. If the caseload goes down, you make money. The caseload went down so far, so fast, that the agencies just had a ton of money. The catch was that the profits were capped at 7% of the contract. So all the agencies immediately were going to make their target profit. And after that, there was no more financial incentive to continue to cut the rolls. It didn't matter to them whether OPAL was on the rolls or off the rolls. They were going to make their profits no matter what. So I think it reduced a financial incentive for them to concentrate on the remaining cases.
Well, Jason DePaul, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Jason DePaul. His book is called American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Coming up, the best of the fall TV season. This is Fresh Air. Television's annual Emmy Awards were presented last night, and the traditional fall TV season begins tonight. TV critic David Biancooley has some thoughts about both and pinpoints the new season's 2 best shows.
Before cable TV earned enough respect to be invited to the Emmy party, before it crossed the 50% threshold of American TV homes, that industry threw its own annual party, the Cable Ace Awards. Last night, cable did so well, and over-the-air broadcast networks so poorly, it was almost like watching the Ace Awards all over again. HBO's fabulous Angels in America swept the various categories in miniseries and deserved every one: Best Actor and Actress, Supporting Actor and Actress, Best Writer, Best Director. But even all the other nominees for Best Miniseries and for Best TV Movie came from cable this year. The broadcast networks didn't even compete in a category they used to own 20 years ago. Today, the broadcast networks are more like disowned from Emmy competition. Last night, if not for 5 measly shows from the Big 4 networks, cable would have won every single Emmy. NBC's Frasier won 3 acting awards, but it's gone now. ABC's The Practice won 3 acting awards. It's gone too, though winner James Spader will continue playing his character in a spin-off series, Boston Legal. NBC's The West Wing won for Best Actress, thanks to Allison Janney. CBS got its only Emmy for a reality series, The Amazing Race. And the major award won by a broadcast network this year for outstanding comedy was won by Fox, one of 3 Emmys given to its daring, delightful Arrested Development. Actually, a cable series, HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, should have won in that category. But cable has no reason to complain. Not when The Daily Show, The Sopranos, Deadwood, Sex and the City, Monk, and the telemovie Something the Lord Made all got statuettes. Angels in America, all by itself, earned more Emmys than CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox combined. That's astounding. For them, it should be embarrassing. Maybe that's why, this TV season more than ever, the broadcast networks are adopting cable models to shape and launch their new shows. For years, HBO has built a Sunday night franchise by running episodes of 1 series each week without interruption, like The Sopranos, then replacing it with something else given the same treatment, like Deadwood. This year, ABC is trying that with Alias, which won't return until after the new Desperate Housewives is over, and with NYPD Blue, which starts an uninterrupted run tomorrow night that will continue until it ends its final season in December. That's a good move, very viewer-friendly. Another cable model the networks are adopting is the idea of launching new shows outside of the competitive fall season. Cable used to do that for a reason, to get notice when the networks weren't hogging all the attention. But now the networks are doing it. NBC launched its new season the day after the Olympics ended, and Fox this year is in the midst of a 4-tiered, 52-week schedule that has even TV critics totally baffled about what's what and what's coming when. At Fox, all I know is that 24 isn't returning until 2005. The abandonment of the unified fall season launch by most of the broadcasters is immensely stupid. Most of their shows aren't strong enough to get attention on their own, and spreading out the fall launch over several months only dilutes what's left of the excitement. CBS and ABC seem to understand this and are launching their new seasons this week. And the two best shows this year come from ABC, a network that hasn't taken many chances lately. This year, it's presenting two new dramas that are so good. Listen to this compliment and everything it implies. They could have come from cable. One of them is Desperate Housewives, a primetime soap with a great cast, a mix of mystery and humor, and a suburban snappiness that seems like equal parts David Lynch, John Waters, and Melrose Place. I'll give that a fuller review when it premieres next month, but keep an eye out for it. The one arriving sooner, also on ABC, is called Lost and premieres Wednesday. One of its creators is J.J. Abrams of Alias, and Lost is even more dense and unpredictable than that series. Lost is about a commercial airliner that crashes way off course on a mysterious island. Eventually, the survivors have to figure out not only why they crashed, but where they are, what dangers lurk in the jungle, why they're not being rescued, and other major question marks. We also learn about each character gradually, through flashbacks, as well as through their actions after the crash. Matthew Fox from Party of Five is the first person we see on Lost. He plays a doctor and spends the beginning 12 minutes of the show tending to others before taking time to tend to himself and a nasty gash in his side. He takes a travel sewing kit and asks a dazed survivor walking by, played by Evangeline Lilly, to give him some stitches and close the wound.
I might throw up on you.
You're doing fine.
You don't seem afraid at all. I don't understand that.
Well, fear's sort of an odd thing. When I was in residency, my first solo procedure was a spinal surgery on a 16-year-old kid, a girl. And at the end, after 13 hours, I was closing her up, and I accidentally ripped her dural sac. It's right at the base of the spine where all the nerves come together. It's membrane, as thin as tissue. And so it ripped open. And the nerves just spilled out of her like angel hair pasta. Spinal fluid flowing out of her. And the terror was just so crazy. So real. And I knew I had to deal with it. So I just made a choice. I'd let the fear in, let it take over, let it do its thing, but only for 5 seconds. That's all I was gonna give it. So I started to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it was gone. Sewed her up and she was fine.
If that had been me, I think I would have run for the door.
No, I don't think that's true. You're not running now.
Believe me, though, she does some running later. So does everyone else in a show that's loaded with twists and turns, that has the look of a major motion picture, and that more than any other has me waiting excitedly for the second episode. For most of the other new shows this fall, it's not even worth watching the first episode. And you're likely to see that reflected next year, once again, at the Emmys.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, a new album from saxophonist Von Freeman. This is Fresh Air. For most of his long career, Chicago tenor saxophonist Von Freeman has resisted many attempts to lure him out onto the road. Though Freeman's now 81, he's traveling a little more in recent years. In 2003, he went to New York to cut a new album. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it was well worth the trip.
Von Freeman playing a blues, Disorder at the Border by Coleman Hawkins. It's from Freeman's new CD, The Great Divide, on Premonition, a salute to his forebears, Hawkins, Lester Young, and Charlie Parker. Freeman can caress a ballad like Hawk, slur a note like Young, or soar above the chords like Parker, but Von doesn't sound like any of them. So the album really celebrates his own puckered, sour tenor sax and patented mix of tender whispers and expressive bleats. He sounds romantic, vulnerable, and playful at the same time. Von Freeman usually records with colleagues from Chicago, which has some very good rhythm sections. But New York has better ones, and it's good to hear him in the Apple with peers drawn from Jimmy Cobb's sextet. Drummer Cobb, bassist John Weber, an ex-Chicagoan partly trained by Von, and the two little heard pianist Richard Wyans. He sounds especially simpatico with Freeman on the blues in any tempo. Richard Wyans is having his own late career revival, but Von Freeman is jazz's classic late bloomer. The first record under his name came out when he was 40. He was 80 when he recorded The Great Divide, one of a few recent albums that show he's still got it, and which feature one of his lovely unaccompanied ballads. Here it's Violets for Your Furs. Freeman is revered in Chicago because he's lovable and has educated dozens of young musicians. The city even named a stretch of 75th Street after him. But in the end, it's the quality of the playing that counts, and Von would be worth cheering even if he stole candy from babies. Thank you.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Downbeat and The Absolute Sound. He reviewed The Great Divide by Von Freeman. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Joan Westman. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video and the DVD release of 500 Nations, a documentary on America's Indian heritage, hosted by Kevin Costner, available September 21st. From the German Information Center, the shortcut to Germany on the web at www.germany.info, and by Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of The Love Wife by Gish Jen, author of Mona in the Promised Land. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Letters from Baghdad, we meet New Yorker writer John Lee Anderson. His experiences in war and its aftermath and his conversations with Iraqis are the basis of his new book, The Fall of Baghdad. And we meet bounty hunter Tom Evangelista, who's featured on a new HBO real-life series, Family Bonds. Join us for the next Fresh Air.